building resiliency is not only for folks that are in public service or that are in academia or that are in, you know, the clinical world. But building community resilience is everybody's job, and that everybody from wherever they stand in the world can contribute towards community resilience.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold. The Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Last year, when Hurricane Harvey hit Houston and other communities in Texas, resilience was a hot topic. As an organization that works in mental health, resilience is more than just a trait of some individuals, but an idea we want to put in practice for the benefit of people and communities. So what do we need to know about resilience? How is it fostered? And what does fostering resilience commit us to doing? Helping us to answer these questions is Wendy Ellis, Project Director of the Building Community Resilience Collaborative at the Milken Institute of School of Public Health at George Washington University. She is joined by Lourdes Rodriguez, Director of the Center for Place-Based Initiatives at Dell Medical School at the University of Texas at Austin. Wendy is joining us via telephone. Wendy and Lourdes, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
So as a foundation, we're very interested in understanding resilience and the social factors that promote it. From both personal experience and your scholarship, what do you see as the hallmarks of a resilient community?
So thank you so much again for the invitation. And when I think about resiliency at the community level, I think about communities that understand that the conditions that create adversity are bigger than an individual. Right. So these are things that are experienced by entire communities, and that because of that, that those conditions need to be addressed at that same level, at the level of the collective.
So, you know, one of the things, first off, you know, in this conversation, I want to have a level set. I want to make sure that when we're using the term community resilience, we have a common understanding of what it is that we're defining here. And so for us in the Building Community Resilience Collaborative, the first thing we want to help people understand is, what do we mean by resilience? And if you've taken a Physics 101 class, you know that typically resilience is defined as an object's ability to bounce back to its original shape after suffering a shock. And when we're looking at resilience, the concept of community resilience, particularly through the equity lens, it's not so much merely that we want people to bounce back, because number one, we recognize that so many of our communities are experiencing a day-to-day adversity that leads to wide disparities. So it's not so much that we just want people to bounce back when we recognize that what their starting point is really less than zero in comparison. But it's also that we have the expectation that our work will provide supports and buffers so individuals and communities can bounce forward. So that's really our concept of resilience. And in order to do that, in order to not only bounce back from an acute shock, but also be able to bounce forward in the face of adversity and in the face of chronic and day-to-day adversity, then a community really does have to have in place those buffers and supports that allow for both. And so when we're talking about community resilience, what we really want to understand is, how are the basic services and infrastructure of a city, of a community, there to support its residents and individuals? So we're looking at very, very discrete but very important components, such as the level of economic development, whether or not that community actually provides living wages for individuals that give them access to affordable housing, as well as access to economic mobility. And so those levers for economic mobility also include basic services such as our public education systems. So are individuals actually able to be educated to a point that they can then have access to livable wages and then have access to financial capital that allows for stable and affordable housing? And at the end of the day, what we're really doing when we talk about resilience, we're looking at this through the lens of equity. Mm-hmm. So resilience does equal equity, and there's no resilience with disparity.
Okay, I'm very grateful that between your two answers, you emphasize both the collective aspect of resilience and also the equity piece of it, and which is I think interesting, but also necessary, because these days resilience has become sort of a self-help buzzword.
Yes,
and
sadly.
It tends to have a very individualistic framing at that. And so I'm really glad that you've kind of bootstrapped us into a more sophisticated understanding of that idea.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think that there's certainly, in the political times that we're in, it is very necessary that we be explicit in these definitions. And that's why in our work it is so important that before we get into describing what it is that we're trying to achieve, that we do have that common understanding.
And it also means that the strategies that we use for fostering resilience are going to be very, very different at the collective level than if you're just thinking about the individual level.
So the last time that we explored the subject of resilience on this show, it was in response to Hurricane Harvey, a pretty significant crisis for many Texas communities. So in your experience, how can communities promote or undermine resilience after a crisis?
So I want to put in context this moment of crisis that Harvey exemplifies,
sure.
Right? So I think about disasters like Harvey as acute disasters. And I think about acute disasters as a magnifying glass, that they help us understand the weak points, like the tender points that are putting people in vulnerable positions, that are putting communities in vulnerable positions. So because then as we are looking to overcome the impact of a disaster as such, an acute disaster, there's a lot of lessons that we can then take to our work in addressing chronic disasters, the disasters of every day that sometimes we don't notice because we think of them as being carried in the back of individuals and not that are experiences at the collective level, right? So when we're thinking about promoting or undermining resilience after a crisis, at the heart of that is understanding that we are all vulnerable, and that if we think about addressing resilience as something that people have to deserve, like you need to deserve being helped after a crisis, then we are undermining this idea that communities can bounce forward, right? So what the opportunity that a crisis, an acute crisis gives us, is that recognition that we are all vulnerable, and an understanding that we need to move from othering and us theming, right? So thinking about the deserving and the undeserving as we promote community resilience.
I agree with you, Lourdes. And one of the things I'd like to add to this is that we really already know quite a bit with regard to what are some of those specific components that help us to predict the strength of how well a community will bounce back after suffering acute shock, whether that be from a hurricane or a tornado or even a man-made disaster. And a lot of this comes from the research that was done by our own federal government, from the CDC to FEMA to Homeland Security post 9/11.
Yep.
And so through those studies, we have come to understand that there are four basic components of community resilience. First one being information and communication. How well does information flow from whether it's from the systems level down to the community level and even between neighbors, from neighbor to neighbor. How well is then we get to community competence and understanding how well can a community survive, given its own, as you referred to it earlier, Ike, as the bootstraps, on the ground, helping neighbor to neighbor, and actually surviving on their own for a given amount of time, before the troops come in, let's say. And so then the other piece is that social capital piece. How much social cohesion was there in that community prior to this shock, suffering the shock? Did individuals really feel like they were vested in their community, and vice versa, did they feel that as if the community were vested in them? And then the fourth component, which I think a lot of times we forget about or overlook, particularly from a public health perspective, is the level of economic development.
Yep.
Is one of the key predictors of how well a community will bounce back after suffering an acute shock. So when we're talking about economic development, we are looking at the levels of retail, the diversity of that retail, the diversity of the workforce, that there's not one sector that that community is dependent upon. And so if that one sector suffers an acute shock along with the rest of the community, then we know that what's going to happen, the bottom will fall out of that community. So these are the things that if we understand from a response perspective, that these are the key components of community resilience and predicting how well a community will bounce back, then from a public health perspective, we should also be looking at how are we shoring up these components in the face of day-to-day adversity so that we can lessen the adversity that individuals and communities are experiencing on a regular and chronic basis in order to, as I said earlier, bounce forward so that when those acute shocks occur, which they will, that we actually are better prepared to bounce forward or at least bounce back from that acute shock and keep moving forward.
And I think, Wendy, that your point, if we can find a gift in a crisis, sometimes it's really hard to think about disasters as gifts, giving us gifts. But one of the gifts that we have is the opportunity to, as we're coming back from a disaster, how can we, instead of just encouraging people to go back to normal, and for example, if you have communities that are experiencing health, food insecurity, like how do we use this as an opportunity to ensure that everybody is now starting from an equitable place of access to food, for example, so that this is an opportunity to start from a different baseline.
Yeah, one of my goals with the podcast in general, not just this episode, is to do more than just have a conversation about an idea such as resilience, but I guess to, as much as I can, actively intervene in how people understand that concept. And I guess this may kind of touch back to a point that you made a little while ago, Lourdes. When I think back to our response to Hurricane Katrina, so like even amid the outpouring of compassion that you did see from a lot of quarters, people still couldn't resist putting those impacted into categories of deserving and undeserving. So deserving, for example, the old ladies who had to find a way to, to get their dialysis in, even amid everything that was going on, versus the undeserving, the able-bodied, who we presume had every chance to get away, but just decided not to. So disasters really kind of call us to account in that way, don't they?
They call us to account. They call us to empathy. They call us to put ourselves in the, in other people's shoes. Because when we are all underwater, we are all underwater and we will all be hungry at the same time, right? So that moment of empathy, if taken as a starting point for rebuilding and for making sure that everybody's needs are taken care of, then we can really move towards equity.
I think so, but what you raise, Ike, in this example really points to some deep-seated attitudes that we have and beliefs that we have in our culture. So when you talk about, those that were deserving versus those that were not deserving, the disaster only created a magnifying glass and actually created a dialogue because we were looking at rationing of vital resources, of even our own empathy, because there was empathy fatigue as well with Katrina.
Yes.
We were all human. The systems had limits. And so as I think part of the rationale for us as humans was to say, well, we can't care for them all, and we can't possibly save everyone. So it becomes easier for us to excuse those that we don't help by somehow blaming them, by creating further issues with regard to them being the others. New Orleans really ripped the bandage off of what was in plain sight. What those people that were living in the huge disparities that only became magnified in Katrina, those were not new. They were only magnified because the levees broke. And so if we were okay as a society with letting those individuals live in such harsh disparities, then you can only expect that we were going to have a limited amount of empathy in their moment of need, moment of crisis.
And thank you for adding that. And that's kind of what I meant when I said that disasters have a way of calling us all to account.
Yes.
The good parts of us as well as the not so good. So do either of you have examples of how a particular approach to the problem of resilience led to a specific outcome for a specific group of people? And what can we learn from it?
So Lourdes and I were discussing this prior to the call, and one of the examples that we have from one of our communities that we work with in Building Community Resilience Collaborative, her George Washington University, is the Fabian School in Portland, Oregon. And before I tell you about the intervention, I want to describe a little bit about the community so that you can begin to understand what they were responding to. And the Fabian School is within the Portland Public School District. It is the largest catchment area of the entire district. It also has the area of the highest concentration of poverty, with students that have a high level of household instability. A large number of the student body are homeless. About 90% of the students are living 200% below the federal poverty level. So you have, and you also have a lot of gang rivalries that occur in this particular catchment area. But it's also an area where you're beginning to see gentrification creeping in, particularly around the campus. And what a trailblazing principal came into the program and said, "This is not enough," because 122 steps from the door of her office sat Concordia University, which is a Lutheran university. And so she began to partner with the university and actually brought in some of their students that began to do art classes with the children. Their education students began to do some of their training there at the school, and they brought in a behavioral health partner, Trillium Family Services, that began to train staff as well as families around trauma-informed supports and practices. And so the questions about why a child might have some sort of behavioral issue in the class wasn't so much about what's wrong with this child or what's wrong with this family or what's wrong with this community. It's what has happened to you. And this is, you know, applying these trauma-informed principles inside this school began to create this this environment of empathy, but also empowerment, that there wasn't something wrong with me because I was living in poverty or that I've come from such an unstable background, but more so understanding the forces that were acting upon us as opposed to the choices that were that we had made. And so what were the results that that result from, you know, coming together such as this way and supporting this community? Well, they've had in the 7 years since they have started this program reduced absenteeism. They've also increased the third grade reading scores at this school. Behavioral problems and suspensions, out of school suspensions, are down. And also really key to this is that their teacher retention levels are up. And so this is about, you know, not only fostering, and I think that last measure there, looking at teacher retention, isn't just talking about the effect that we're having on students, but it's also looking at the effect that we have on staff. And I think that this is something that is really key when we think about how do we treat community resilience. It's not just those individuals that are living there, but we also have to think about the vicarious traumas that individuals who are working day to day in these conditions, what they suffer, what they have to deal with in dealing with families as well as themselves, the traumas that can come forth in this work. And so recognizing those things, I think, are really key to the beginnings of real, true community resilience.
Wendy, I'm so glad that you defined this example as a program. but that you described it not as a recipe that is followed, that has very strict framework for how things are done, but that is more relational than programmatic in the traditional sense that we think about programs. Because I think that at the heart of problem solving to build resilience is thinking about our approaches as relational as opposed to following as a specific set of steps or a process that constrains us from being innovative.
And Wendy, please send me some more information about the school, because I think that some folks here at the Hogg Foundation would really like to know more about it. So if you could do that, I'd really be grateful.
Absolutely. And I would encourage your listeners to, if they're interested in also taking action in our work, that with all of our tools, all of our BCR videos that tell the story of the work that we're doing, this isn't something that, you know, you have to have a technical resource center such as George Washington University to help you. We are taking everything that we've learned and put it out there for folks to use it. And all of that information is on our website. It's at go.gwu.edu/BCR.
Okay. Thank you for that. So, Lourdes, you direct the Center for Place-Based Initiatives at Dell Medical School. So I saw on your website that you recently put out a call for ideas. What's the goal of that?
So we can find better solutions to problems that impact health if we involve people that are directly impacted by health inequities. So we encourage everybody and their mother in the Austin, Travis County area to share with us what are their ideas for solving or even defining problems that impact their health and the health of the communities, or opportunities that they see for building population health. And so we think that ideas that are for, by, and about people that are impacted by inequities are often lacking in the academic research enterprise. So we really think about, for example, research as being informed by research that was done before. So we're trying to make room at the center for folks that are not necessarily part of generating knowledge and problem solving to come alongside with us as partners. And our goal in identifying these ideas is to figure out what are the resources needed? How can resources be used in a different way to test some of these solutions that are presented to us by our idea originators? And how can we make those sustainable and incorporated into the way that we improve population health? Building resiliency is not only for folks that are in public service or that are in academia or that are in, you know, the clinical world. Like, building community resilience is everybody's job and it's everybody's responsibility. And we can all contribute towards that. And that everybody from wherever they stand in the world can contribute towards community resilience.
Okay. So that does it for this episode. As I mentioned earlier, our episode on Hurricane Harvey hit on themes that are highly relevant to this conversation. And so if you're on SoundCloud or iTunes, I strongly encourage you to look for episode 50, Hurricane Harvey, Faith and Resilience. Or you can find our blog post about it on the Foundation website, hogg.utexas.edu, which contains links to that episode. Lourdes and Wendy, thanks so much for joining us.
Most welcome.
Thank you.